You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
The first idea that I had when I read the lyrics was, oh, I should go, and we'll never be royals, and then have a choir of you going, royals, afterwards. And she was like, oh, yeah, that sounds okay. And then we just recorded it, and over the course of 2 days, mapped that song out.
2 days, yeah, yeah, wow. Number one in the US for 9 weeks.
Yeah.
It was only number one in New Zealand for 3 weeks. don't get too far.
Classic Kiwis, yeah.
Number one in Canada, UK, Spain, Sweden, Belgium, Ireland, like, just is ridiculous.
Yeah.
What's the role of a producer? Like, what do you actually do?
That's the million-dollar question. Yeah, sometimes I don't really know.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. And today is something a little bit different. I've been excited to release this episode for some time, and it's going to require a little bit of backstory, so bear with me. In mid-2024, we sat down with Rowan Simpson, early TradeMe engineer, founding employee turned top startup investor, to get his advice on planning the Blackbird Sunrise Festival for the end of 2024. He had this incredible idea to profile one of the quiet ones, this idea that the founders of startups, rightly in most cases, get a lot of the credit for a given success, but behind the scenes, a lot of the impact is actually folks who are, you know, the early employees, the pivotal advisors, the early supporters who are so critical to building the machine yet often get overlooked or underappreciated. Secondly, we had this idea that, you know, we wanted to explore the extended metaphor of building startups, becoming this creative act. You know, it's not dissimilar to the journey of an artist or a musician, for example, who emerges from obscurity to make it on the world stage. Now, if you drew a Venn diagram, at the intersection of those two worlds would be Joel Little, at the very, very top of our list. He's one of the quiet ones. He's a producer and songwriter on Lorde's hit, Royals, scaling his Grammy award-winning career to working with Taylor Swift, Imagine Dragons, so many more, you wouldn't believe it. Because Joel is a definition of quietly shaping the global hits from behind the scenes. Today, I'm excited to bring the live recording of Rowan sitting down to interview Joel in Wellington, though, to be honest, Joel flips a script and interviews Rowan half the time as well, which is really part of what makes it so magic. They break down the striking parallels between music and startups, discovering raw talent, helping develop their early identity, the product, into something that the market resonates with, to navigating the early chaos as you start to catch on, to see product market fit, to scale, and stay true to your vision, your culture while scaling. We really double-click down into the how the Kiwi culture scales and sometimes limits us around the world. Joel shares his journey from musician to producer to selling his catalog, an exit event in, you know, the local lingo, and to launch what has now become a foundation for emerging Kiwi artists with Big Fan. Whether you're building a startup, whether you're making music, or just interested in Kiwi culture on a world stage, this is one for you. I won't waste any more time. Here is Rowan Simpson in conversation with Joel Little.
I've got a million questions. A million things I want to ask you, but let's start with the myth of the lone genius.
Okay.
I think in startups, the spotlights often shine on the founders. And I think that's true of a lot of the artists that Georgia just listed off then too. But it always takes a team to create something great, even if one name is always like attached to the work.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can start with that question. Like, what's the role of a producer? Like, what do you actually do?
That's the million-dollar question. Yeah, sometimes I don't really know. It's I mean, the producer's role is basically that they're in charge of the overall sound and feel of the song. So the way that they might, like, for example, I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston was originally a Dolly Parton song. Two very different versions of the same song. Two different producers have made it sound the way that they
right, the same
wanted
core
it to sound.
Yeah. Underlying material.
Same song, but very different sonics. So there's that. That's probably the main role of a producer. But then there's also the psychological side, which is being encouraging, hopefully helping them figure out what it is that they want to say and how they want to say it. And often with some of the younger artists that I've worked with, or artists at the beginning of their career, it was helping them figure out what they wanted to sound like in the first place.
So you're a therapist.
Honestly, some writing sessions do feel like that. Yeah, you're just like going in, you kind of have to get to the core of what the person needs to write about that day, rather than just, you know, let's write a song about a breakup. It has to actually come from a genuine place, ideally, if it's going to be something good.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're going to get to all of the stories of the great things that you've worked on, but maybe you can just drill in a little bit on that collaboration, like in the studio, like, what exactly does that look like? You're in a pretty confined space with mm-hmm. someone pretty famous.
Yeah.
And working on things that are half formed.
Yeah. I mean, often it's working on, like, it's starting completely from scratch too. So everybody's just showing up and there isn't, sometimes someone will come in with the start of an idea, like a melody or a few chords or something. But often it's like, what should we make today? And yeah. It usually just starts with a conversation. And often there's like an hour at the start of a songwriting session where everyone's just chatting about what's been going on.
You haven't even picked up the instruments.
No, just kind of trying to, especially when it's someone that you haven't worked a lot with, you have to get to know them a bit because there's a lot of trust involved with songwriting and any creative endeavor. So it's trying to kind of get to the heart of how they're feeling and maybe get past the initial thing that they're like, oh, I feel like I should write this type of song. And then like, yeah, but what type of song do you really need to write today? And let's do that.
And so, we'll come to that role of collaboration, how you pick. I mean, I'm honestly quite envious that you get to call yourself a producer. I feel like we haven't in startups found the equivalent sort of language.
Cool word yet. Like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you can say that and sort of people will nod and go, oh yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate it when people ask me what I do.
Yeah, well, I do want to know. because we've had a few conversations now, and I know that you've obviously been a part of some incredibly successful things, but what do you actually do?
It's a little awkward because there's some people I suspect in the crowd who I've worked with, so
right.
I can't kind of blag an answer I've had a lot of different roles in these companies. Like I started at Trade Me as the engineer. I was writing software code, right through to, in the case of End and Timely, I guess I was much closer to the therapist role
right.
that you were talking about at some points in those companies. And so it's hard to pin it down, I think if you ask my mum, I think she still thinks I just fix hard drives on computers or something like that.
But so you have the technical skill to do a lot of that stuff.
That was my background, yeah. And I think that was my gateway into this. Mm. I mean, not dissimilar to you, right? You're a musician first before you were a producer.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I think that's an important foundation. I think that gives you something to build on.
So how did you discover the skill to like beyond the technical side to kind of become more the Yoda in the room, helping people figure out where they wanted to go with things?
Yeah, I mean, that transition from being an operator, from being a doer to being an investor or advisor, what I'm from now on going to call producer for companies was a whole new skill. Like I don't think I was especially good at it to start with. And I sort of had to learn what worked and what didn't work. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's true for you too. Like not every great musician would be a great producer and not every great producer was a great musician.
No.
Which is no slight on your guitaring.
No, I'm not. So it's very true when it comes to me, but I definitely didn't set out to be a producer. That was just something that similarly, I guess I kind of evolved into. And I started recording my own songs just out of necessity because I was writing so many and I didn't have anyone to record them for me.
Yeah.
And then figured out over time that there was a skill in there when it came to working with other people that I kind of had, and I just had to figure out how to develop it and get good at it.
That's cool. I mean, the last role I had at Trade Me was head of product, I suppose. I'm not even sure if we would have used those words way back then. And I think now I think of the companies that I work with as the product rather than the software that we're building. Like we're building up these companies, but it's a lot of the same thinking that can apply.
Yeah.
To those situations, you sort of, even just that mentality of thinking about the end user and working backwards from there to the technology, for example, applies just as much when the product is the company that you're trying to build up and maybe ultimately sell.
Yeah. So in your world, like often in the songwriting world, sometimes you don't know what, you might start out with something and be like, let's kind of do something in this sort of world. But by the end of the day, you've gone off on a tangent. You've just kind of followed, where the inspiration took you.
Yeah. So we do have a word for this in SARS. We call it pivoting.
Okay.
Which is a word we've shamelessly stolen from basketball.
Yeah. 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 I've heard a lot of words today it's like a completely different language.
Yeah.
Than the one that I normally speak. But okay. Pivoting. Good. Yeah.
There you go. So, I mean, the idea is you keep one foot planted like in basketball, netball, right? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you can go off in a new direction after that.
Yeah.
And if you're going to do that, probably better to do that sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Before you spend too much VC money.
Right.
So maybe let's rewind to July 2012.
Okay.
Turn your mind back. When you worked on something pretty remarkable that became quite well known.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's actually a little sample maybe we can listen to.
I've never seen a diamond
Yes. Yeah.
You recognize it?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I know this one.
And I'm not proud of my. So you're credited as the producer, but also joint songwriter, actually, for that songwriting credits, with a then 15-year-old called Ella, that people may have gotten to know a little since then.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how you met her. Like, how did you start working together with a 15-year-old?
I know, it does seem a little sketchy. So my now manager, his name's Ashley Page. He signed my band Goodnight Nurse back in the day. He was working at Warner Records at the time, and he had gone into management and independent label work, and he had seen her. Somehow all the record labels had seen Ella perform at some school talent show when she was like 12. I don't know how that happened, but anyway, he'd been saying for a couple of years, there's this girl, she signed this development deal with Universal. She's really good. She's 14. And I was just like, this seems so weird to me that I was like 28 at the time. And I was also kind of new to the whole collaborating thing as well. Like, I'd only ever really written songs with close friends, like other members of my band. I'd done some of the Kids of 88 stuff at that point, but that was with, like, Sam, the singer from Kids of 88, was also a Goodnight Nurse. So he was a close friend.
Knew.
Yeah, people I knew. And so I was just like, seemed like the whole collaborating thing is kind of scary, let alone with a 14, I think she was 15 by the time she came in, but when they were talking about it, she was 14. Anyway, it just seemed weird. But then he was like, you really should, like, I'd just done a song for the band that won the Rockquest that year, who ended up becoming Broods. They were early incarnation of Broods. Yeah, Nelson. And so I think there was a little bit of, they'd noticed that I could work with younger artists and had a bit of a knack for that.
Yeah.
I had a little sister that was Ella's age.
Right.
Same age as her. And so I think, yeah, she came in and kind of instantly I was just like, oh, this kid is not, I mean, she's already seems way more mature and smarter than I ever will be. She just had a way about her. And so that kind of put my mind at ease in that regard. And then we just started like playing around with ideas. It was like, we kind of had the luxury then, like she would come in during the school holidays, or if it was like sports day at school, she'd take the day off and come to the studio.
Yeah.
So we kind of, over a period of months, she'd come into the studio and she was like, she would play me cool like remixes of things that she'd found on Hype Machine, which was a big website at the time. And I was playing her like old Snoop Dogg, and just, we were kind of like, you know,
trying to find overlap, basically.
Yeah, and then every now and then we would kind of toy with an idea of a song. And then one week we just were like, let's just make a song. Let's make a different song every day, and let's just make it sound like some of our favorite artists. Like, each one, today we'll do one that sounds like Lana Del Rey. Tomorrow we'll do one that sounds like Grimes. We'll do one that sounds like James Blake. And we were just like, just to try stuff. Because she didn't really know what she wanted to sound like. I don't even think she knew if she really wanted to be a musician. She was like, I'm just giving it a try to see if it's gonna, if it feels right. And that week we wrote a song. On the last day, I was like, why don't we just make a song that's just only your voice? Like, we'll make all the instrumentation out of your voice. And it was a song that was called Million Dollar Bills that was on her first EP. And I ended up putting a beat into the song later on. But on the day, we were like, oh, there's something about this one that's really interesting. It's kind of got this kind of pop hip hop thing, but it's also all about her voice. And that was when I was like, this is where the magic is, because her voice is so unique. And then the next time that she came into the studio after that, she'd sent me most of the lyrics to what became Royals. And my only lyric in that song that I came up with is Tigers on a Gold Leash. She did all the rest of the lyrics, but she thank you.
It's a good line.
It's all right.
The others are all right too.
And so she came in and And we talked a bit about kind of what we wanted to sound like. I'd made, I think just on the spot, made like basically the beat that you hear now because it's so minimal. And then one of the things I always used to have to say to her is, this is going to sound crap when I sing it, but when you sing it, it's going to be good. And the first idea that I had when I read her lyrics was, oh, I should go, and we'll never be royals. And then have a choir of you going, royals, afterwards. And she was like, oh yeah, that sounds okay. And then we just recorded it. And over the course of 2 days, mapped that song out.
2 days, yeah, wow.
And then it was done.
Amazing. So fast forward now a year, 12th of October, 2013. Mm-hmm. Royals is number one in the US Billboard charts.
Yeah.
Fun fact for the people as old as me in the room, Lorde was the youngest artist to have a US number one since 1987. Mm. Tiffany, you remember that?
Vaguely.
You're a bit young. I remember it well. what have you been doing for a year? Like, what do you do between those 2 days while you record this amazing piece of art and then a year before the rest of us realize that it's great?
I mean, I was just still being like a broke musician, just like hustling. And I'd set up a studio prior to meeting Ella. So I'd set up this little studio. I'd started doing music for TV commercials. And so that before that, I had been in the band for years, but never made any money with that. Mm. Then I had a kid. I was like, holy shit, how do you like...
Yeah, time to grow up.
Yeah, exactly. I was fine on 2 Minute Noodles when it was just me, but then I had a family to support. So I kind of figured out that I had a knack for this ad writing thing. And so I'd set up the studio, but it was basically like anything that came in the door, I kind of had to do. So the song started to take off, and then we quickly got in for 3 months and made Pure Heroin, the whole album. Yeah. So that whole thing was made the start of 2013, like as the song was showing signs of maybe blowing up, but well before we knew it was actually going to be as big as it was.
I mean, I sometimes blush when people talk about the companies I've worked on, but honestly, like the accolades for this are almost unbelievable. Like number one in the US for 9 weeks.
Yeah.
It was only number one in New Zealand for 3 weeks. Don't get too far.
Classic Kiwis. Yeah.
Number one in Canada, UK, Spain, Sweden, Belgium, Ireland, like just is ridiculous.
Yeah.
14 times platinum, which means 22 million copies sold. I don't know how the sales and streaming work now, but 2018 Rolling Stone magazine ranked at number 9 in the greatest songs of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And it won Song of the Year at the Grammys.
Song of the Grammys, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about what it's like to have that kind of global success, because... I imagine you meet a bunch of interesting people and that there are some experiences which are kind of pretty confronting at the time. Or maybe like is your job done as a producer by then? Are you just kind of watching?
Yeah, initially nothing really changes because there's such a massive gap between the song being successful, earning a bunch of royalties, and then it's like a year before you actually see any of those royalties. So I was still like...
You were still a poor musician.
I remember at one point I was in the studio... in my little studio, and I was recording some kid, even younger than Ella, I think, who'd won some competition, and she was singing opera, and while I was sitting there, Tennis Court, another one of our songs, went number one in New Zealand, like the charts came out, and I was like, oh, cool, my song's gone number one, and then they were like, oh, cool, and
back
then
to work.
Just back to like recording this little opera singer. It wasn't until... once it went number one, that was when a lot of the doors opened in the States. And actually, my manager was like, we need to get over there and meet some people. Because I had the good fortune of suddenly every single door over there was open to me. And everybody was like, who the hell is this kid and who the hell made this song?
Yeah.
And we want to work with him. So I was like, time to try and take advantage of that.
And I mean, you made some good choices. We've got a couple of other samples, I think, if we want to cue those up. Some other things that people might recognize.
A couple other songs. Yeah, okay.
I'll do what it takes. Whatever it takes.
I had no idea you were behind that. I've literally used that before I've gone to speak and looking at some things before.
Yeah, it's a big one for sports highlight reels.
Yeah,
as well.
Right. It's good for good for the royalties.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that same ESPN. Year. That same year I did this other song. Quite different from that one.
I'm so high at the moment. I'm so caught up in this. Yeah, we're just young, dumb, and broke, but we still got love to give.
Did you write the lyrics to that one?
I didn't write the lyrics to that one. That was all Khalid. Yeah, so that song now I think is my biggest streaming song. That song's Diamond in America as
right.
well now, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, but that was 2017. So there was a 5-year period from when we'd written Royals to when I had the next kind of majorly successful thing happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite
so a long
gap.
Time between drinks.
Yeah.
Amazing. I think the most interesting thing about you as I've gone to know you a little bit is that you seem completely unchanged by that success. I suspect that if I'd met you beforehand, you would have been probably just as recognizable, which seems really inconsistent with what we all think we know of rock stars. So, or the mythology of rock stars, right? So, like, how did you avoid all of that? Like, why are you not like kind of washed out on cocaine somewhere?
Mm. Well, I think when I was at that age where I could have potentially got into that world, I was still a super broke musician, couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
That's the main reason.
It's a good reason.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I had our first daughter, Lila, it was a struggle. And I was like, okay, I need to like get my, I'd been fine kind of floating around in the band, but I was like, I need to like get my shit together and figure out how I can do this thing properly and at a high level. And so I think my motivation just like, I'd always been motivated, but the motivation really kicked in at that point. And it was, just probably being a dad helped. But
yeah,
most of the really successful artists that I work with are not like crazy. They don't live the crazy rock star lifestyle. That's how they've managed to to keep level head and keep as successful as they have for a long period of time, because you just can't live like that and actually be productive.
Yeah. How much, talk to us a bit about the pros and cons of being a Kiwi in that world, maybe, because it feels like you're quite canonically Kiwi in your approach to that world as well. It seems like you'd be unfazed by a rock star when you met them.
I think so. I think New Zealanders are good at just treating everybody kind of equally. And I think that is actually a really beneficial thing.
It's a superpower.
Yeah, because in my world especially as well, it's like trying to get people to relax and be themselves. That's when they are their best creative selves too, when they feel like they can trust you and they don't feel like they have to put on an act. They're just more likely to do something that's a bit more honest maybe.
Yeah.
So I think that's helped me. I think there's definitely been like, There's a little bit of the Kiwiness that we could probably do without sometimes, but we're not good at talking ourselves up and
So talk a bit about that. Like do you consider yourself ambitious? Like I assume you don't kind of buy into that kind of chest thumping American version of ambition, but
no. I am. I love the thrill of the chase of trying to. I love the whole. I've always just wanted to do the best that I could possibly do with whatever was in front of me at the time. And so whether that was, playing Goodnight Nurse and touring New Zealand, it was just anytime there was a new opportunity, I was trying to take advantage of it, whatever that was. And that's kind of led me down this path to being a producer, even though that wasn't necessarily, I didn't even know that it was a viable career option when I started out in a band. I was just like, it's fun making songs and going on tour with my friends. So,
Plus, I think, I don't know, there's, for me at least, I spent a bit of time in the States with Vaughn during Venn trying to raise money from American investors. And we sort of discovered that our Kiwiness wasn't really helping us.
Right.
It was starting to hurt us. Like I remember one meeting where the investor said, how's it going? And Vaughn said, it's going pretty good. And you could sort of see his face slump because to an American,
pretty good
means bloody terrible. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas to us, pretty good means pretty good.
Yeah. 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 So, that's high praise.
It's pretty good. Yeah. Yeah. we went through a phase where we were kind of like trying to convince each other to be more American, be more American in the meetings.
Yeah.
And it totally doesn't work because it's not authentic.
Yeah.
I think we eventually worked out that we need to be more Kiwi.
Yeah. I think so.
And lean into that.
I think it's just authenticity is so important. I feel like there's people that, that I work with that I can tell want me to be like that, and I'm just I can't.
You kind
and
of so, push back against it.
Yeah, well, I just am myself, and I am enthusiastic about things when they are pretty good.
Yeah.
So I can do that. But I'm bad at pretending to be enthusiastic about things that aren't good.
Yeah.
And I think that's good.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, who wants? It's just a. I don't know. It feels fake, and it's a. It's just kind of time wasting. Like you can't fake something actually being good. Like you can, you know, be enthusiastic in the room at the time.
Yeah.
But then as soon as you play a song to anybody else, they're going to know straight away if it was good or not. Yeah. I always liked, especially in LA, we would have these nights where people would come around to I had a studio in my house over there, and everyone would come over and have some drinks, and it would always end up, you know, 2 a.m. in the studio, and everyone would play each other the songs that they had been working on recently.
Yeah.
And I loved it because it was such a good, it was like a good testing ground, because I would, as to which songs I would actually play them.
Yeah.
All of a sudden I would be like, right. Oh, this one and this, like, I want to play these ones, but that one, which I have been telling myself is really good, I don't want to play them because I'm being honest with myself.
Yeah,
about
right.
It's not actually good.
So it flushes it out.
Yeah, yeah, it's good. I love doing that, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, there's probably a lesson for many of us in that, in terms of the companies that we talk about too, those of us who work with a few.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, surely in your world, you have to be passionate about the things that you're going to get involved in.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's another myth, the idea that they're like amazing and obviously great when you go into them. Like, you know, I think like the process of making them great is actually what makes them interesting companies to work on.
Yeah.
And so that necessarily means they're often not great at the beginning.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I it's a repeated experience I have where that process of kind of telling other people about the companies that I'm working on and effectively pitching that to them kind of guides you to what it is that's exciting about it.
Yeah.
It might be hard to articulate that straight away. And, you know, often it's the people rather than the idea or the product in the beginning that is exciting.
That's the part that has the potential.
Then you work it out. Like, you know, and as you kind of sharpen that story about it, you actually build your own enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then you can start to, you know, really authentically say, this is amazing and you should invest in it when you're talking to an investor.
So through having the discussions, it becomes clear what the actual valuable parts of it are.
Yeah, or not. Like the opposite is also true. I think, you know, the more you work on it, sometimes it reveals itself to actually be not as great as you might have hoped.
Yeah.
That's when you need to pivot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to see, I know that you said that you had an example of early Trade Me.
Oh, yeah.
Situation. Speaking of things that developed into something great.
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah. Can we pull that up?
It's a little bit different.
It looks great to me. It's pretty good. Yeah.
Pretty good.
The most amazing thing about this, actually, this was Trade Me in 1999. There's a lot of nostalgia here, actually. Netscape Navigator, for those of you who are old enough in the room as well. But this is what Trade Me looked like when I started working on it. And we thought it was great. Like, I would have said that was great.
Yeah.
Especially the logo, pre-Kiwi logo. Like, can we just zoom in on that?
Yeah.
I think if you click to the next, yeah, there you go.
Oh, yeah, beautiful. So when did you, how far along before you changed the logo?
I mean, pretty quickly. pretty quickly. I think Sam gets all the credit for that original logo. I think that
so good
is from the Microsoft Wingdings font.
Yeah.
It's like emojis before there were emojis.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just colored them in.
Yeah.
That was the logo.
Oh, good.
I mean, you know, like, let's not pretend that these companies that became great companies were great and obviously great at the beginning. They were, you know, pretty ordinary.
Yeah.
But
there was something, there was a little something in there
to get started. Yeah.
It's the same with, I love working with newer artists for that same reason. Like, it's fun working with the big stars, but I've had a lot of success working with people who weren't big when I first started working with them, and I've helped them figure out
how to be big.
I've just helped them figure out what they wanted to sound like. If they were like, I just don't really know just yet, like, this is the kind of music that I like, and I want to make, but I don't know what my version of that is. And so,
yeah, let's find it together.
That's what I get in there and do.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to call myself a producer from now on. okay, so that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Sorry to make you feel a little old, but if we bring this into the present day, like Georgia, as we were walking on, listed off some of the artists that you've worked with since: Taylor Swift, Broods, Sam Smith, Imagine Dragons, Ellie Goulding, Khalid, Shawn Mendes. Like, it's a long list.
Mm.
I'm interested to know how you choose. Like, you can presumably choose to work with pretty much anybody now because of what you've done. Like, how do you choose who to collaborate with? What are the traits?
There's a couple of things. The first thing for me that I learned, especially after working with Ella, was if the person has a unique voice, just literally the way that they sing. Like, they don't have to be a great singer, but if they have a unique voice, I feel like that is already a great step towards setting themselves apart. Like, I'd much rather work with someone who sounded unique than sang all the notes perfectly.
We'll talk about how technology can fix that.
Right, yeah, that can be fixed, yeah, easily enough. But so there's that. That just makes my job a lot easier, because I feel like if you're not trying to disguise a crappy voice with a bunch of music, you kind of like, you can just get to the heart of the song and keep it quite simple. I do like to, when I can, just production-wise, keep things pretty simple to stay out of the way of a great voice and of what the song's trying to be and say. So a great voice, and then also something to say, something unique to say, or a unique way of saying the same thing that everybody else says.
Yeah.
You know, like writing there's a million love songs, but people are still writing new love songs that connect with people in a different way.
Fact that Ella was a poet first before she was an artist.
Yeah. I mean, she would like bring in words on a page and be like, I don't know what the chorus is or what the, like, and I'd be like, well, this part feels kind of like a chorus. And I'd never really written songs. Like, when I first started writing songs, I would sit with a guitar and hum a melody and then try and find a lyric that fit the melody.
Mm.
Whereas with her, she had all these amazing lyrics, and I was like, okay, well, how do we sonically and with the chords and with the melodies tell the story that this lyric is, that these words are telling? Yeah. And do them justice. And that was really fun. Like, I wish that more people would write like that, actually.
Yeah.
I'm always encouraging artists to bring, I mean, some people just, yeah, you know, you have to work however works best for you. But
sure, yeah.
Yeah. And she quickly learned as well how to still write great lyrics to a melody. Like, I would hum a melody, again, doing my, this is going to sound crap when I do it, but.
Yeah.
And then she would go away and write a lyric and come back and sing it, and I'll be like, damn.
So the traits you've described so far are still kind of how they sound or what the words are, but like, talk about the personality traits maybe that you look for. Like, how do you decide that someone is someone that you're going to enjoy working with, or maybe enjoy is not the right thing to optimize for?
I mean, I guess those first couple of things are before I even get in the room with them. Those are the things that I like. If I get sent a bunch of music, a bunch of different new artists, or even with bigger artists, like, I've definitely said no to big artists, much to my manager's, you know, disappointment, just because I actually thought that I couldn't. I was like, they're better off with someone that is enthusiastic about their music, and that does that kind of thing really well. Like, the other thing is, when I hear it, I have to feel like there's something that I can add to the equation, which is probably similar for you with your line of work.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. Yeah, if I don't see a role for myself, it's kind of, you know, it's just money then that you're investing.
Yeah.
And there's lots of people who can invest money.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I kind of try and find pretty quickly when I'm deciding whether it's someone I want to work with is just listening to the questions that they ask.
Right.
Like, I get a lot of people who reach out and say, you know, can I have coffee? I'd like to pick your brain.
Yeah.
It's like, that doesn't sound like fun, having your brain picked.
Yeah.
But like, when they come with a specific question and they say, you know, I'm wrestling with this gnarly thing.
Yeah.
And it seems like you might be someone who could help me with that. Like, all of a sudden, that's a much more interesting conversation.
So what kind of thing would that be? Is there an example of that?
Yeah. I mean, if I think back to some of the original conversations with Ryan and Scoff, who were the founders of Timely, for example, they had a pretty good product sense. Like, you know, that was my background was in product and in building things, but that was also their background. They could do that pretty well. And they were thinking a lot about the shape of their venture. Like, they were trying to decide if they wanted to go down the more aggressive venture route or more bootstrappy kind of approach.
Yeah.
They were trying to think about, you know, they had a little bit of money from their previous exit. And so they were trying to think about, you know, how aggressively they should scale. And so they were really just wanting advice around that kind of the shape of the company and how to think about building that company product that I was talking about before.
Yeah.
And those were fun conversations. I was, you know, I was way more interested in talking to them about that stuff. And we actually, it took about a year of those conversations back and forth before we all kind of sheepishly broached the subject of, you know, maybe I should invest in this rather than just have lots of coffees with you.
Yeah.
But, you know, that long incubation period, I think, is one of the other things that made that a great venture. It was like there was a pretty solid foundation of working together.
You built trust and...
I had very high confidence that they were going to be great founders and that I'd be able to contribute to it by the time that investment happened.
So is it generally you'll take that amount of time before you really dive into something?
No, sometimes I've been much faster than that. But I think if you plot the ones that have been great, they're all the ones that were longer.
Yeah.
You know, like the ones, someone else said this actually earlier today, the fast decisions weren't always the best decisions.
Right.
I mean, the other, I guess it sort of ties into that as well, is I try and find coachability. I don't know if this is relevant to you, I suspect maybe, but like someone who can listen, take on that feedback, put their own stamp on it, and then do something with it. Like, not just kind of ask for advice for shits and giggles, you know, but to actually make the thing better.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess as a producer, my role in that situation would be, like if somebody's singing a song and it could be as small as like, I can't understand those two words in that line. Can you say them a bit?
Yeah.
Or this needs to feel a bit, you know, like I'm not really believing what you're saying, like those kinds of things. And that being able to do that with someone.
You have to kind of know them to be able to say that.
You have to kind of know them. And there are still some people who are like, I think it's fine the way it is.
Yeah. Right.
And you're kind of like, well, it's not, but it does get to a point. And that's generally, I guess, another thing like that. Once you get in the room with someone, you find out if they are willing, if they're wanting it to be a collaboration, a partnership like that.
Want to make it better.
Cause I don't have the type of personality where I'm like, no, this is the way that it has to be, because they're also the one that has to go out and sing it and perform it every day. And so if they're not happy with it, then, that's not a good way to end the day. But at the same time, if I think that...
Yeah, and sing it thousands of times.
Yeah, forever. Yeah, it's a successful song. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, when I'm with Khalid, there's a song called 18, and the chorus lyric is, because I'm 18 and I still live with my parents. And then, but he was about to turn 19, and I was like, you're gonna have to sing the song. You're like, we should change the story of the song. Needs to be like looking back on it after the first chorus, because I was 18, and then that'll make a bit more sense. Like, when you're performing it a bit later on,
I love it.
It's just little things like that. So it's finding people that are willing to just genuinely collaborate, and it's not like a power tripping competition. Yeah, just.
And do you think you can, like, what's your success rate of being able to tell in advance if someone's going to be good to work with like that? Is it better than a coin flip?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it's not a huge amount that aren't willing to collaborate. Generally, it just happens every now and then. And sometimes there are artists who I'm like, I love their music. I feel like I could really bring something and add something to this. They seem cool, and then we get in the studio and there's just no creative connection whatsoever, and we're both like, damn, that sucks. Like, I wanted it to work and it just doesn't. You can't force it. Like, it's a thing that can, I guess, it can develop over time, like you say. But sometimes, especially in the songwriting world, sadly, you only have like a day or two,
a few days,
with them, because they're, you know, you're both in LA, they're from the UK or whatever, or they're off on tour and you're going back to New Zealand. And if it doesn't work that first day or two, then that's kind of your shot.
Since you mentioned LA, let's go down that road. Like, can you just quickly compare what it's like doing the work you did in New Zealand with the time you spend in LA? Like,
I love going to LA. It's super intense. I lived there for 4 years and was definitely ready to be back in New Zealand more when we moved back. But I do love the hustle of it. I especially, I think, as a Kiwi and being quite laid back, It's good to be around that energy. It kind of like lights a fire under you a little bit as well.
Mm.
But I always joke and just say, I love going to LA and then I love leaving after a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Because it's good to...
That's exactly how I feel about San Francisco. Like for you know, for tech companies, that's kind of the center of the universe.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing place to visit. It's like an injection of optimism and energy. And it wears you down after about 48 hours.
Yeah.
If it does for me anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun to go there. It would be harder to be there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of figured out how to have my version of LA, like, you know, which areas to hang out in, which avoid. I had the studio at my house, which always helped. But I do, I do love going over there. But then being able to come back to New Zealand and be away from it and be away from all of the, you know, the fake enthusiasm.
Yeah.
I feel like I hear songs differently in New Zealand than I do when I'm there.
You hear them differently.
Yeah, like a demo that I've made there, I'll come back here and be like, oh, that part's not good. That part needs to change. Like, it just gives me a good perspective on it, and I can listen to it in less of a, without buying into all the typical like bravado nonsense talk over there of everything being amazing.
Yeah. So you need a bit of it, but not too much of it.
Yeah, it's a balancing act.
Yeah. Like I think one of the interesting things I reckon is when you go to Silicon Valley, an American startup doesn't call themselves a US startup.
Mm.
But like a New Zealand or an Australian startup goes there and they call themselves a New Zealand startup.
Why is that?
I think it's a crutch.
Right.
I think it's it would be much smarter for them to just acknowledge that they're just a startup like everybody else. And right. I suspect that that's true for artists in LA. Like you can, you know, by the time you get there, you're one of.
Yeah. Yeah. You're there for that reason. And generally everyone that's there has kind of reached the simple. I mean, there's a lot of people out there just slogging away and trying to get their chance. But everyone's acting like they're already a star. That's for sure. Yeah.
They're actually a barista.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll keep the timeline rolling.
Mm-hmm.
2021, you sold your catalog.
Yes.
So this is, I mean, another piece of jargon for you, what we would call an exit.
Okay.
How did you decide to do that? Like, was it hard to sell your babies?
Yeah, it definitely was. It was the reason that I decided to do it was, I mean, it made financial sense.
Yeah. Someone offered you more than...
Yeah, exactly. It was an offer. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse. But I kind of felt like at that point, like when I'd, after the whole Lord thing happened and our lives got completely upended and, you know, changed, and it was an incredible ride to go on. But we weren't trying to make a big successful song. We were just trying to make something that we liked.
Sure.
And so I felt like I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it again. And I kind of set a few goals and did that a few times over. And then I would say that the pinnacle of that was the Taylor Swift working with her, which was an amazing experience. But then after that, I was kind of like, man, I've been doing it at this level now for 10 years, like 20 years total from when I started Goodnight Nurse when I was 18 or whatever. And I feel weird. Like I feel like now what? Like there was like a kind of a weird, and so then the catalog sale thing came up and it just kind of felt like it was closing a chapter, closing one chapter, and made me actually feel more motivated about, okay, well now I'm kind of like royalties wise, I'm not getting any, because when I sold the catalog, now this other company collects all those royalties and
yeah, of course,
that's what they will with them. So I was like, I'm not getting any royalties. I kept my production royalties. So I sold my songwriting royalties up to the end of 2019.
I don't know, it's a bit like selling the UI and keeping the database or something like that. But
But they're two different royalty streams.
Yeah.
So the producer royalties come from the recording of the song. Songwriting royalties come from the actual songwriting.
Yeah.
So I still was getting the producer royalties and still working as a producer. But it actually motivated me to be like, hey, well, now I got to like try and build a second catalog and see the chances of it being as...
Start again.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I don't know if it'll ever get to the level of that... of the first one, but it's kind of exciting to start again and just push myself and see where I can.
It's kind of amazing. Like this is my experience. You have this amazing big success, and the first thing everyone asks you is, "What are you going to do next?"
Yeah,
I'm like, Jesus, man! Like,
I just did something
pretty good. Like, yeah. Pretty good, you know. Yeah. And yeah, like it is. I totally resonate with that feeling of like proving to yourself that you can do it again.
Yeah,
that was definitely the feeling that I had.
Yeah,
you know, working on subsequent ventures, and I think I can relate to the feeling of that kind of exit too. Like, there was a moment for me in 2021 where Vend and Timely both were sold or acquired within quick succession, and felt great. Like, it felt really validating to know that all of that work that we'd put in with all of those people,
yeah,
and it had been a rocky road, and for both of those companies,
yeah,
but to have that as kind of the thought that would stick in people's minds about those companies, it was a nice feeling.
Yeah, that's cool. So did you have like was it a daunting feeling, what's next, or was it like you're excited or?
Yeah, so more recently, no, I feel like I went through this post-trade me where like, I found myself getting quite angry when people asked me what I was going to do next,
because
like they had been hard enough in my mind. And I was really lucky that the way that fell for me, I was able to work, start into a new startup, which turned into zero, which was ridiculous. Yeah. But like, that was a young team, and it was sort of, we were starting again a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, I guess I went through that then rather than more recently.
Right. Yeah. Got a bit more perspective on it now.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I'm interested to hear what you're doing now as well, because you haven't just kind of
taken the
money. You're doing the work,
but you're
also doing Big Fan. So talk a bit about that, because that's super interesting to me.
Yeah. So we'd already bought the building before then. I sold the catalog.
Yeah. Which does speak to the royalty checks you're getting. Joel just spoke quietly.
Yeah. I mean, I was just wanted to do something nice, man.
Yeah.
My wife and I bought a building in Auckland, in Morningside, and we've set up a charitable foundation. So we've renovated this building and turned it into a not-for-profit multi-room recording studio and live music venue, all-ages live music venue.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And
it's so cool too. Like, it's a great space.
Cool. There's a real lack of, especially all-ages venues around. And this is like 200 capacity. It's perfect for new bands to come and cut their teeth, and we put in state-of-the-art sound system.
Cut their teeth, did you say?
Yeah. State-of-the-art sound system, and all the studios have all the same gear that I have in my studio. Like, I really wanted to make a point of making sure everything.
Yeah.
When people are in there, they know that they're using the same stuff that I use every day
to
make big songs.
It must be awesome.
It's so cool, and we have had a whole run of different programs that we've done over the last year, and one of the things that I got sent through some stats yesterday, one of the coolest things was we did this thing for a year and a half, and through all the programs, 205 songs were written by new, like younger writers and producers, which is super exciting to me. Thank you. Just the fact that 205 pieces of art that didn't exist now do. Super cool.
Yeah. And I mean, this is how ecosystems develop, right? So well done for doing that. Like, and the exact same thing in startups, like, seeing the people who have worked on these companies that I've had the privilege of working on at the very beginning now come out of those and start to work on their next ventures.
Yeah.
Or even just feeding their advice into the next generation of ventures. Like, that's how success builds. So
yeah.
Well done, man. I think the screen is about to start flashing red at us. So
cool.
Thanks so much for your time. It's been a privilege to chat to you today.
And that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe over in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing in your feed every Friday to help power you through those weekend chores. For my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing best Kiwi and Aussie founders, no matter where they are in the world, back home with global ambitions or out there building generational companies. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say there's no check too early, so drop me a line anytime. That's dbooth@blackbird.vc. This episode was produced by Day One, the podcast network for founders, operators, and investors, and is part of the Day One network. Thanks again. Look forward to seeing you back next week.